So the obvious first question is, what attracted you to real estate that you came into this industry when you were trying to make a decision what you were going to do with your life?
I mean, I might have a different path than most, in that I didn't sort of seek out real estate from college. I was a biomedical engineer. Everybody in my family was doctors, planning to go to medical school. My parents had passed away, so I was sort of on my own, making ends meet through college, and happened to get into Northwestern's medical school. And during the process of the interview process amongst many medical schools, I started questioning, you know, whether this industry, because I think you could even see how quick it was changing back in, and this is in the very early 80s. And I deferred for a year and ended up working for J&B Realty just by chance. And they had a placement ad in the Northwestern Placement Center for an analyst. And so I applied for the job. And I think, and this maybe goes partly to your second question, what made, you know, J&B a great training ground is even the question they asked. It was very, I think, intuitive, real estate discussion. I remember them asking me, so if we send you out to go look at a shopping center, what's important? What would you do? And that, you know, question as a sort of college graduate without any, now back then there were no real estate classes, I had no finance classes. It was, you know, sort of the obvious, well, you'd go drive around the trade area, look at the shoppers, look at the stores, try to figure out what the growth was in the area, and, you know, answers like that, away from, you know, the financial side that I think a lot of people start at in real estate now. And then my first day on the job, which actually I was thinking about, it was almost 30 years to the day, within a couple of days of today, I showed up and they gave me a ticket to Denver. And they said, here's three apartments that we're thinking about buying. You know, we want you to go out, figure out what the real rents are, and come back and report to us on, you know, what the actual rents are for the apartments. And then you'd go and talk to a few of the people, you know, a few years older. Okay, what should I do? How do you go about doing this? And so it was a very, I think they gave you a lot of responsibility early on. And a year later, the day I put in my deposit, I was supposed to go basically as across the street from the Hancock building across the Northwestern Medical School. It's almost kitty corner across the street. And I showed up at 7 or so in the morning, 7:30 in the morning. I think I was supposed to be there at 8 or 8:30 for the orientation. And I just was having so much fun, I never showed up. And in some ways, I feel like I've been doing the same thing ever since, is that I go out and look at some properties and try to figure out, you know, is this something we should try to buy and can we move the cash flows up? So I think it was, you know, it's just, I really enjoyed what I was doing, and it's given a lot of responsibility at a young age that I enjoyed, and I've been doing it ever since. So I think it was more learning, getting thrown into something that is new, learning it, enjoying the people that we worked with, both within the company and outside the company over the years. It's a great industry, great individuals, great friendships, and so that is really how I ended up staying in the real estate business.
What do you think J&B saw in John Kukrow that attracted them?
You know, maybe the answers to some of those questions, that I'd work hard, that I could get the job done. There was very little job description back then, and they had hired most people from business schools. There was only, I think at the time, one other person, Carl Tash, right, who had started as an undergraduate but then went on to business school. And in the original placement center was for a job in market research, which quickly sort of transformed because of everything going on into really acquisitions work right away. So, you know, I'm not sure. And I remember, you know, a few of the guys, you know, Bruce Duncan, a month or so into it, you know, running to my office and throwing, you know, a package on a property and said, you know, Kukral, I'd like to review this with you tomorrow morning, get your thoughts. And I had no idea what to do. And he asked me, you know, the next day will, you know, be calculated, you know, like the IRR, you know, the returns. I said, I don't even know what an IRR is, you know, being an engineer. And I had to learn it by going through the, you know, the book that you used to get with the 12C that had the
right.
Calculate, you know, the formulas of what all those functions meant so I could understand what was coming out of it. So, so I think I ended up getting a lot more responsibility probably than I had any training for early on. And the company was growing fast at the time, which is always important to, you know, I think being in a business that's really growing. JMB grew dramatically from, you know, obviously before I arrived in the late 70, you know, 78, 79, 81, 80, 81. Then 82 through 88 grew dramatically. So I think that, and the two, I think the responsibility they gave people attracted people. And back then in the 80s too, a real estate career, it wasn't just JMB. Trammell Crow, you know, the other real estate groups were going to the business schools, hiring business school graduates to come in and work on the real estate, and the whole industry sort of professionalized, I think. Not that it wasn't, but really institutionalized, you know, through the 80s until the downturn in the 90s.
Well, let's see what we can or can't learn from JMB. I mean, if you look at, and I obviously know them going back to the early 70s when I was a banker. But you sort of look at the group of people who were the graduates, Schreiber and yourself, who went to Blackstone and clearly established Blackstone as a player in the industry. Barry Sternlicht, mm-hmm. You know, who was Starwood. Carl Tash became a well-regarded money manager. You know, Bruce Duncan is running public companies. Mm-hmm. Doug Cameron is running, you know, healthcare companies. So. What was it? Was there something in the water?
The successor,
which is Bloom and Walton Street and all that. What was in the water that so many successful people came out of JMB?
I think you have to give a lot of credit to Neil Bloom,
mm-hmm.
in that he allowed people, even you look at Schreiber, came in as a young guy. I think he was probably one of the first people they hired,
absolutely.
You know, right out of school. And he had real responsibility in a growing company. And Neil would, you know, he didn't really care if you were new, if you'd been there 10 years, there's no hierarchy really. If he wanted to go through a property, he'd run down to your office, he'd give you a call on the phone, you'd run over to his office, and you'd sit there and, you know, spend hours going through the numbers with Neil. Or he'd say, you know, I want you to come up Saturday. And you sit up at his house and plow through the transactions. So I think, again, it was giving, hiring, you know, I think a lot, they hired very intelligent people, motivated people, and it was there were no strict rules on how you sort of broke out from being a young analyst to going out and working on things yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And so you just, as you had the gumption to go do something, you could go do it. So I think a lot of credit has to go to Neil, and that he had a very flat organization. I mean, there was a hierarchy that was sort of put in that just helped keep things organized, but if you had a good idea and you had a could find a property that made sense to buy, you know, the group would support you to go get that done. So it was a great training ground. And we also worked on all aspects of the transaction, which is something I tried to do at Blackstone, and I still try to do. And I was just with one of, you know, a colleague, a young colleague who had hired out of school, and we try, even with our analysts, to get them out, to get them go see the properties, to, you know, do the full underwriting, then to, if we're moving forward, to work with the lawyers, to read the leases, to get down into the weeds on the properties, to work with the operational people to understand the expenses. And this person, and we, you know, nowadays we hire the people, keep them for 2 to 3 years, and they move on to other jobs. And in their new role, they say, well, we underwrite 10 times more properties, but we really don't ever get out and see the real estate anymore. And again, I think one of the good things about JMB is that we were out in the field working on things, where nowadays people can spend a lot of time just getting books in, running numbers, and having somebody else give them the input. And okay, here's what I want you to put into rent, I want you to do this, and they just run the models. Where I think at JMB is a very hands-on experience.
Obviously, you've taken that, you know, that's part of, you know, what is the basis of how the new company operates. Can you tell us a little bit about, you know, Northwood?
Yeah, I think at Northwood, and like I said, in some ways I feel like I've been doing the same thing forever. So in some ways we're doing the exact same things we did at JMB, and the same is we grew the business at Blackstone, is that we try to go out and make the best risk-adjusted investments that we can, and really work for our investors. You know, first and foremost, I always felt like that I worked for our investors, that I really didn't work for JMB, or I didn't work for Blackstone, you know, I don't really work for Northwood. We work for our investors to go out and find good investments on their behalf and try not to lose their money. And if we buy right, you know, the future will take care of itself. So it's, I think that investment mentality of working for your investors is something that I think was sort of drummed into us at JMB, same at Blackstone, and we continue that at Northwood. And I think, as I said before, try to emulate what, you know, how JMB was organized, where we hire bright young people, and you give them a lot of responsibility, you know, with a lot of support, but allow people to learn and grow in the business.
But, you know, it's interesting. Well, I hear you speak, and I hear other managers of the large private equity companies, and you just seem to have a different view. You're more property centric in your comments. You're more long term view. You're not trying to see if you can cut the cycle short and make a profit. Does that argue that, you know, you've got a different investment philosophy, or you've developed a different philosophy than, you know, some of your competitors?
Well, I think maybe it comes down to the background. And in the early days, at JMB, we always looked at owning properties for the long term. And a lot, you know, we had numerous pockets back then, but, you know, even the income funds held for fairly long term compared to today. The pension funds, the separate accounts, the commingled funds took a longer term view. And we did that at Blackstone. We started Blackstone, you know, as in Blackstone, prior to bringing in myself and Schreiber, had bought a number of the RTC pools, actually with Joe Roberts, Savers 1 and Savers 2, which were the liquidating pools. By the time we were really up and running in 94, we made a conscious decision that there were a lot of people chasing the pools. We were going to chase, you know, the restructuring of the properties themselves. and that we felt the better properties that we bought as the cycle improved, that the better properties would outperform, you know, the lesser quality properties. So we always sought to buy the best quality properties that we could. And I think also took a long-term view as an owner of those properties to do what's right for the asset over the long term. And we felt that we'd get paid for that when we went to sell it. And if you look back through those years, what we told the investors is that we buy it, we fix it, and we sell it. And we basically did that. We churned through properties pretty quickly. And I think that worked, you know, for a moment in time when you had a fairly distressed property market and you're going to have a lot of turnover of assets. And when assets are over-leveraged, you don't get much reinvestment in the properties because the owner generally is pulling the cash flow out and not wanting to reinvest in the properties because they don't know if they'll own them a year, 2 years, 3 years down the road. Mm-hmm. So if you looked at what was out there to buy, many properties were underinvested in, underleased, etc. So the idea that you could buy something, put capital into it and put a lot of elbow grease into it and get it back to, you know, what now you call a core property. You know, that was doable, but I don't think that's sustainable over a long period, you know, a long career. I mean, you can do it. You can always find opportunities, but it's not the bulk of the real estate market in more stable times. So what we tried to do, and this maybe goes to Northwood, what we tried to do at Northwood was build a longer-term model where we could invest our money alongside of our investors, but take more of a, as you would a private owner of real estate, where if you have good properties that can continue to perform well, why just sell them to hit a high IRR? And in essence, you sell it and you buy the exact property, you know, in another city or across the street, right, with a new fund.
You pay twice as much and get half the yield.
Right, or you basically get to pay roughly within margin the same price of what you're selling. Now, if you are disciplined enough then to go buy something that has flaws that you can correct and use your expertise to improve it and keep doing that, you know, that's not really almost a quasi-development model. I think people can do that. But I think sort of high return model forces you almost to sell your better assets. I mean, I don't even say better assets, but the ones where you have a big win. So if you bought something and you just somehow ended up through your hard work, but getting something at a high price that a year later somebody's willing to offer you a lot for, you generally sell it to bank that high IRR. Because if you can double your money in a year, it's roughly a 100% return. And it's not going to be sustained. It's just going to go down every year after that. But with the way the fund model works, you want to bank that 100% return. And on the other hand, if you have a property that you shouldn't have bought, and you bought it for 100, it's now worth 80. If you sold it, that's a 20% loss. Well, if you wait 10 years, it's a 2% loss over 10 years. So it's actually, you're somewhat rewarded in your IRR to hold your losers, and you're penalized if you don't sell your winners, which in the JMB days, we filled up a fund. I remember really look at it, and the ones that you should have never bought, you said, why should we spend so much time on that? Let's just get rid of that and spend time on the better assets where you can really add more value.
That's one of the things, that I learned from Judd Malkin.
Right.
If we can't fix it in a year, it's gone.
Right, exactly. And he was the one who said, if we made a mistake, just get rid of it. I'd rather spend my time on the good assets.
Right.
But the opportunistic model is almost the opposite.
And
right,
you could not convince him to keep it for another 6 months, no matter what you did.
Right. Right, he didn't want to have three more meetings about something to save $5 loss when you could focus on making $20 on another property.
Last question. One of your kids comes to you and says, "Hey, Dad, I'd like to get into the real estate business." What do you say to him? That may not be that far
away. Actually, it just happened last year. So, and this not for publication, but my oldest son, who is a civil engineer, architecture major, and I thought he was really going to go into more city planning. He worked for City of Stanford, MTA.
Mm-hmm.
And he just decided he wants to go more into development now. And, you know, so I think all you can do is try to, in a quiet way, I don't believe in you know, really trying to give him something. But I can, you know, when he says, "Here's some companies I'm interested to," I can say, "Okay." And I think, and maybe my son, he's sort of still very young, so he'll, you know, say, well, for example, JBG here in Washington was looking for a development analyst on, you know, their website, and he hit it and said, "Here's a job opening." So, he applied, and I'm like, Jimmy, maybe you should write some of these people directly, you know, and I think they'll recognize your name, and
right.
Just let them know, besides the personnel office, that you're interested in working there. So you try to give them some guidance, and I actually told him he should join the ULI, so I think he'll join it, which I think will be a little strange, having, I've seen other people having your son wandering around the, meetings at ULI will be a little different, but, he seems gung-ho about it, but I think in any industry, the key is that you really enjoy what you're doing. And I think that's the hardest thing when we hire young people out of college. They, they say they want to go into real estate, but do they really want to? Do they really have a passion for it? And we have a lot of very smart, very talented young people who, over the 2 or 3 years, just don't rise to the occasion. I think because they really don't enjoy the business. And other people, maybe even they're not as, smart, but they really get up every day enjoying what they're doing. And I think that in any profession is one of the big keys to success, is that you find something that you really want to get up in the morning and go and do. And actually one of the, I remember as a young person, as I said, trying to decide about medicine, is one of their early thoughts I had is like, all our family friends are all doctors, right? You go over to somebody's house, it's another doctor, you do this, another doctor, it's all doctors, and all they do is talk about doctor operations and, what they did today, and they did this procedure, that procedure, and I go, that's like pretty limiting. My dad would always say, when he was alive, that the good thing about medicine is you can, once you get your MD, you can really do anything, right? It's just, nobody can take your education. It was a vast field. And I think that's the same advice that I'd, give them on real estate. Like, you don't know, will you really enjoy development, leasing, finance, architecture, planning? And there's so many parts of the real estate industry that, and it really fits all personalities. And you just have to start and hopefully gravitate to a portion that you really have a passion to and like. So, we'll see. But it will be different having somebody who's interested in it.
Okay. Thank you, John. Thanks for being here. You're perfect.
All right.
It's perfect. Exactly. It's exactly what we want.
Yeah. No, it is fun. It was. It was.